Welcome, everybody. This is the sixth lecture of the Mises Academy online class, Keynes, Krugman, and the Crisis. Today we're going to be talking about the Japanese lost decade and the relevance to the United States and the rest of the world in our current mini-depression or severe recession, whatever you want to call it. So let me just say this is a backdrop to what we're doing here. In this particular lecture, more so than probably any other one, I am going to not be summarizing the reading that you are assigned, but rather I'm going to just be filling in some of the gaps and explaining some of the things that the readings may have alluded to that you wouldn't know unless you are hip deep in this stuff. Okay, so again, for this particular lecture, this week's material, there's no substitute for you just going and reading the stuff, and it's pretty simple stuff. I mean, it's not real high theory. It's a Mises.org article, a blog post from this guy Scott Sumner, and a few things that Krugman wrote for the layperson. All right, so this stuff shouldn't be all that hard. So, like I say, especially if you're taking the class for credit, I'm going to design the multiple choice questions this week to force you to go read the stuff. So if you just listen to this lecture, you're going to get a 40% or something on the multiple choice this week, because I'm going to put in specific things to make sure you did the reading. Okay, so let me give you some background information that may help fill in the gaps if you were reading this stuff about Japan and didn't know various things. So one thing that we need to get down is the distinction between the monetary base in the broader monetary aggregates, things like M1 and M2, because this is pretty crucial to understand what the Keynesians are saying, well, what both the Keynesians and the monetarists are saying regarding the causes of and then the solutions for serious economic depression, such as we had in the 30s and then what we're having right now. Okay, so some definitions here. The monetary base, what do people mean by that? That is currency held by the public, so actual in the United States, actual green pieces of paper that are in your wallet or your purse, plus bank reserves. All right, so now bank reserve, what do I mean by that? I mean what a commercial bank can claim as part of its reserves. So just so you know, the reserves are what a commercial bank uses to back up its overall customers' deposits. So what can a bank point to, a commercial bank point to, is its reserves? Well, if it's got currency, green pieces of paper, sitting in its vaults, those are reserves. Or if the commercial bank itself has deposits with the central bank. So in the United States, if Citibank, you know, is a regular commercial bank that customers, regular people can have checking accounts with Citibank. Citibank's reserves, what are those? It's green pieces of paper, you know, $100 bills, $20 bills, and so forth, in Citibank's own vaults. And if Citibank itself has like a checking account with the Fed and says, hey, what's our balance right now? And Ben Bernanke looks it up and says, oh, right now you have $300 million on deposit with us. Now, that $300 million on deposit with the Fed, that doesn't correspond to green pieces of paper anywhere. That can just be computer entries. You know, that could just be stored somewhere on the Fed's books electronically in terms of the Fed just keeping track in its book how much does Citibank have on deposit with us. Up $300 million. Okay, so that's part of Citibank's reserves. So you add up all that stuff, that is the monetary base. You go to all the commercial banks, you say, how much currency do you have physically in your vaults, and then how much do you have on deposit with the Fed, if we're talking about the U.S., and then you look out at the general public, and you count up how many actual paper dollar bills they physically hold. And those two numbers together are the monetary base. Now, what's M1? M1 is the currency held by the public, green pieces of paper, in their physical possession, plus the public's demand deposits at commercial banks. Okay, and depending on your the definitions, there might be some other stuff in there, but these are the main components. All right, so as far as what the differences you need to know tonight between the monetary base and M1, that's why I'm just hitting on these big things right here. Okay, so that's if you understand the distinction between these two, that's all you really need to know for tonight. Because then M2 adds some stuff. You know, M2 is everything M1 is plus some more things. M3 adding even more stuff and so on. But you'll get the distinction if you just know that that's important here. So, crucially, notice that M1 does not include bank deposits with the central bank, you know, bank reserves with the central bank. And the monetary base does not include the public's checking account balances, except insofar as they're backed up by cash in the vault of a commercial bank. All right, so if you just look at those definitions, just think through it as to what the one thing is saying and the other. Notice they're not, if you do like a Venn diagram, they intersect, but one is not a subset of the other. Okay, so the monetary base includes things that M1 does not include and vice versa. So we're going to see that when the central bank tries to engage in expansionary monetary policy, things can get screwy because of that. And you can see that why the Fed might be trying to expand the monetary base, but yet M1 doesn't expand as much. So why don't we go ahead and look at that. So here we're talking about the United States, and I typed out the whole phrase United States to make sure you don't get mixed up. So even though tonight's lecture is mostly about Japan, you need to understand these concepts, and I think it's easiest to illustrate it with reference to the United States because the difference is so stark. Okay, so this chart is showing from 1990 through the present, base, monetary base, which is the red line, contrasted with the M1 monetary aggregate, which is the blue line. So you can see when the crisis kicks in 08, they both shoot up. But the red line shoots up far more than the blue line. So the red line basically has tripled, more than tripled, since the crisis kicked in, right? Because it was a little bit above $800 billion when the crisis kicked in, and now it's, what is that, like about, I don't know, I'm just eyeballing it, maybe $2.65 trillion. Okay, so that's more than tripled. Whereas the blue thing from that point on, that was maybe about what, 1.5 trillion, and now maybe it's 1.9 trillion. Okay, so that certainly went up, but nothing compared to the increase in the monetary base. So what happened? Well, let me show you the quick answer. That's what everyone's talking about, excess reserves. Okay, so that's what we're looking at right here, excess reserves in the United States. You see how historically, this goes all the way back to 1959, this particular chart. Historically, they hug zero. And then you can see how when this crisis kicked in, they just go through the roof. And, you know, this is the kind of diagram that you can show people to freak them out and say hyperinflation is coming, and this is why I was so freaked out in late 08, and so was, you know, Peter Schiff and people like that. It was because of this kind of chart. So part of what we're going to do tonight is explain, first of all, why haven't we had hyperinflation in the United States? And then we're going to go through Krugman's explanation. And Krugman, so this, what we're talking about tonight, part of it is, I think, the strongest card Krugman has to play. So by the end of this lecture, you'll fully understand this, but I'm just trying to explain to you why this is relevant, why we're bothering to go over this stuff. Because I really want, I'm assuming most of you taking this class don't like Krugman and you think his policy prescriptions are horrible. So this particular episode was, at least to the outside observer, I think something where the Austrians, at least some of us, made a mistake, and Krugman apparently won. All right, so I'm just, you know, there's no point in me hiding that. I'm just going to admit that a lot of us, not everybody, you know, some were more cautious or maybe they completely understood this, what we're going to talk about tonight, but a lot of us saw charts like this and said, holy cow, we're going to see massive price inflation the next few years. This is crazy. And even though we have seen it in commodities and things like that, we haven't seen it in some of the more pedestrian consumer price indices. And yeah, there's a, we can talk about all this stuff if you want, about how the government fudges those numbers and suppresses what the real inflation rate is and all that stuff. And that's all true. But, I mean, Peter Schiff was openly using the word hyperinflation. And, you know, I didn't use that. I don't think I used the word hyperinflation, but I said something like, why I expect serious stagflation. And so we certainly have seen stagnation, so we were right on that score, but we have not seen the type of price inflation at the grocery store that I thought we would have seen by now. So that's partly what we're going to go over. And moreover, like I say, Krugman has just been running victory laps nonstop. Just he keeps saying over and over, you see, that's why the Keynesians are right and the Chicago School and the Austrian guys are stupid, is because they've been saying since 2008 we're going to see massive price inflation, whereas I and the other Keynesians have said we're not going to see it because we recognize this is just like what happened to Japan, and we see that Japan's actually threatened by deflation. All right, so again, that's why we're going over this, because this is a crucial part in the argument. Krugman's going to say the U.S. right now is going through what Japan went through and is continuing to suffer through, and Krugman thinks anybody who saw a chart like the one we're looking at right now and said, oh my gosh, the dollar's dead, is just an idiot who didn't bother learning the lessons of Japan. All right, so to understand, so what's the relationship between this chart? You know, we're going to get to that stuff in the rest of tonight's lecture, but for right now, let's make sure I'm not losing anybody. What's going on in this chart? What is this excess reserves, and what does it have to do with this chart prior to it with the red line jumping up, whereas the blue line is just rising more modestly? All right, so what happened is in the fall of 2008, Bernanke starts engaging in all this unprecedented intervention. So he just starts buying assets, writing checks on thin air, buying stuff from investment banks. You know, they were sitting on mortgage-backed securities that the market didn't want to touch with a 10-foot pole. So a lot of these investment banks were basically insolvent, and they were all going to go under. So how does Bernanke save the day? He comes in and just starts buying these assets from them, or doing things like lending them reserves and taking on the assets as collateral, and just continually rolling those short-term transactions over and over. Right. So they did all kinds of crazy stuff. Those of you who are in my anatomy of the Fed class, you know, we went through that stuff in painstaking detail, all the different special programs the Fed inaugurated during this crisis, right? But in terms of big picture, what was going on is Bernanke was taking on assets onto the Fed's balance sheet, and this is also, of course, all the QE, rounds of QE. So there he's buying mortgage-backed securities and treasuries. So how's the Fed doing that? He's just writing checks on thin air, writing checks to commercial banks and investment banks drawn on the Federal Reserve. He gives it to them. They put it in their accounts. And so now on the Fed's ledger, now Citibank has an extra $1 billion in reserves because Bernanke just wrote a check for $1 billion buying assets from Citibank. So the Fed's assets went up by $1 billion. Because now they just, you know, acquired some more mortgage-backed securities, treasuries, things like that. But now Citibank looks at its own checking account balance with the Fed, and oh, it's $1 billion higher. All right, so since those reserve balances are part of the monetary base, that's why this red line shot up so much. Let me get my pointer going here. That's why this thing shot up so much. Basically, you know, so it went from a little over $800 billion to what, about $2.7 trillion. Okay, that reflects how much in assets the Fed has acquired since this debacle started. But the quantity of money held by the public which is what people most people think of as M1, or some people think of it as M2, that hasn't gone up as much because of this fact, this next chart with the excess reserves. Because what normally what happens is when the Fed pumps in new reserves by buying assets, typically, and this is the textbook explanation of expansionary monetary policy, so you normally when the Fed wants to expand, wants to create more money, what it does is it buys assets, puts reserves in the banking system. Now, initially, those are called excess reserves. They're reserves that the commercial banks have over and above the legal minimum that they need backing up their customers' checking account balances. So right now in the United States, there's roughly a 10% reserve ratio requirement. It's not actually 10%, but just say it's 10%, because it gets real nitpicky about the type of accounts you have and all that kind of stuff. So just for sake of argument, say it's 10%. So what that means is the commercial banks, they look at all the customers, all of their customers' checking account balances, add up that number, and then they need 10% of that number in reserves. So let's take it, say it's Citibank. Let's say their customers collectively have $20 billion in deposits. So, you know, Joe Smith has $800 in his checking account at Citibank. Ford Motor Company has $200 million in its checking account with Citibank, and so on. You add that up, and all of Citibank's customers collectively think when they check their ATM balance, they think they have $20 billion on deposit with Citibank. So with a 10% reserve ratio, the Fed says to Citibank, okay, since your customers have $20 billion in deposits with you, you need to have $2 billion set aside in reserves backing up those deposits. And so, because that's 10% of $20 billion. So what can those reserves consist of? It can either be literal paper currency in Citibank's vaults, $100 bills, $50 bills, so on, or Citibank's own deposits with the Fed, the Citibank's electronic reserves with the Fed. So when we're saying they have excess reserves, that means now they have so many reserves, you know, that's over and above that 10% that they need. So what's happened here, the reason this thing has shot up to such a high level and why historically it hugs zero is because normally when the Fed buys assets and pumps reserves into the system, there's a brief period there where those reserves are excess. When they first hit, they're excess. But then the banks go and they make more loans. They advance more loans to their own customers, the general public and businesses. And so then that means the required reserves go up. So if Citibank gives a loan to somebody who wants to go buy a house, you know, so grants a new mortgage, a business comes in and says, hey, I want $1 million to invest in buying new equipment for my factory. So Citibank, you know, runs the numbers. Yeah, that's like a good loan. And they go ahead and let the guy open up a checking account balance for $1 million. So they go ahead and do all that. Citibank is just creating money out of thin air, the same way the Fed does. Citibank is just opening up accounts for these customers and crediting their checking accounts with these numbers. But it can do that because it's got those reserves that are currently excess. And so the more it does that now, the higher its own customers' deposits are going up. And so that means you keep taking 10% of that number, so the required reserves go up and up. And so that means, so eventually, if they make enough new loans, what initially was an excess reserve is now classified as just a regular required reserve. Okay, so it's kind of confusing. It's when you say, like, oh, initially there was 100 million in excess reserves and then it dropped down to zero, it's not that the banks collectively got rid of the reserves. No, the banks can't get rid of the reserves. The reserves are what they are. Total reserves are determined by the Fed, and the commercial banks just hold them. Or the public could take them out. If the public withdraws it in cash. Okay, but the point is, what can make a given amount of reserves held by the banks excess or required is their own loans to their customers. And that's a thing that the Fed can't directly control. The Fed can't make Citibank give loans to business people or to give mortgages to people. the Fed can write checks and buy stuff and control the reserves that Citibank has, but the Fed by itself can't directly make those reserves either required or excess. Because to know if reserves are required or excess, you have to know how much in total customer deposits the bank has, because the required reserves is just 10% of that number. All right, so again, to repeat, going through this history here where you see the excess reserves hugging zero, don't think of it as, oh, there must not have been much inflation going on. The Fed must have been just treading water. No, all along, let's go back here. See the monetary base. I only go back to 1990 here, so it's not as apparent. But the monetary base, generally speaking, rises throughout history. I mean, it has brief ups and downs in the late 90s and so forth, but I mean, it's higher in the year 2000 than it was in the year 1920. So the reason this excess reserve line hugs zero is because anytime there were new reserves pumped in that were initially classified as excess, the commercial banks collectively would make more loans. So the total customer deposits would go up, so that now what was originally excess reserves are now reclassified as required, and so they're no longer excess. Okay, so what's happened now, the reason this thing is so high and is staying high, is that, yeah, Bernanke injected, whatever, $1.6 trillion into the commercial banking system by writing checks for that amount and acquiring assets, but the banks aren't lending more money, or they're not lending much more. And so we see part of what's been going on here, the reason this blue line is going up is I think the public, I haven't double checked this, but I'm almost positive that the public has withdrawn actual currency, like the actual amount of cash, green pieces of paper held by the public has gone up since the crisis kicked in, because everyone's freaking out and they want to really hold something very liquid. They don't even trust the banks. They want to hold actual green pieces of paper. So they've bulked up on that. So that's partly why this number has gone up. But the point is the banks have not been lending out nearly as much as Bernanke has been pumping in, and so that's why M1 has not risen nearly as much as this red line has. Okay, we got to move on just because we got so much to cover, but I hope I hit that from a few different angles and you at least get the basic gist of that as to why, even if the Fed is being incredibly expansionary in the things it can do, you might not see the total quantity of money held by the public go up. So the point is, of the $1.6 trillion that Bernanke has created, not that much, you know, there's really only, about $400 billion or so of an increase in the quantity of money directly controlled by the public. And so that's part of the explanation as to why you haven't seen a loaf of bread go to $20, is that most of the money that Bernanke has created is just sitting on deposit with the Fed. It's not in the hands of consumers who are going to the grocery store and using that new money to bid up the price of bread. Okay, we got to move on. So looking at slide D now, the 1985 Plaza Accord. The reason I'm mentioning this is because Ben Powell talks about it, and this is important to understand what happened with Japan. Why did it get into trouble? Well, in 1985, I think it was in September of 85, there was a meeting in the Plaza Hotel in New York City, so that's why it's called the Plaza Accord. And France, the U.S., United Kingdom, Japan, and West Germany, their representatives all got together and they agreed they were going to do a coordinated intervention in the foreign exchange markets to allow the dollar to depreciate against the yen and the Deutschmark. So specifically what they were doing is various central banks were using dollars, you know, their stockpile of dollars to then go and buy yen and Deutsche Marks, so that would be pushing up the dollar price of those things, or what's the same thing, pushing down the yen price of the dollar. So here I've shown you, just you can see how dramatic it was. This is a chart of the yen-dollar exchange rate. So notice it starts in 1970. Well, actually, I think it starts in 71. And you can see back then, you could get about, what is it? I'm moving the arrow down so I can see. A little under, just shy of 360 yen for $1. And then it plummets during this, you know, inflation of the 70s. Then it rises a bit, and then it kind of surges, perhaps because of Paul Volcker and the strong economic growth under the Reagan administration. And it peaks in 85, and then when that Plaza Accord goes through, look at the thing just crashes. Right, so here it was, what about, just eyeballing it, let's say 270 yen to the dollar, and then it goes down here to about 125. All right, so that's just a pretty sharp crash in just a few years. So this is supposedly good for the United States because it boosts exports. And on the flip side, it's devastating to the Japanese economy, at least their export markets, because now with the yen appreciating so strongly, that makes Japanese products very expensive to foreigners. So other things equal, what's going to happen is you're going to have deflationary pressures in Japan, right? In order for them to try to export stuff to foreigners, they're going to need the price tags quoted in yen in Japan to go down, because now the yen is so much stronger against other currencies. So for foreigners to be able to afford to buy cars and television sets and whatever made in Japan, the yen price quoted in Japan has to go down, because now, you know, that convert, like, foreigners with their own currency can get such fewer yen with their own currency compared to before. So now, because of that problem, what ends up happening is the Japanese Central Bank does the exact wrong thing from an Austrian point of view. They inflate. They cut interest rates, and they inflate because they're having a recession. So now, incidentally, I don't know the politics behind the Plaza Accord, because the way Wikipedia explains it, and that's just where I went just to get the basic information to tell you guys about it, Wikipedia just says matter-of-factly that those five countries met and the goal was to bolster U.S. exports. Like, that was the whole rationale of it. So it's a bit weird. Why would the other four countries, well, I guess we don't know what was happening with France. We don't know if some of the other countries were benefiting too. But why would Japan and West Germany agree to something whose rationale was, oh, the U.S. is having a lackluster economy, so the U.S. wants to become more competitive by making Japanese and West German exports less competitive? You know, given the mercantilist framework, why would the Japanese and West German officials agree to that? And maybe it was just, well, because, you know, NATO was there and the U.S. is like, well, if you don't go along with this, we're going to let the Soviet Union take you over. You know, I don't know. It could have just been something like that. But it certainly, the way the Wikipedia article describes it, it was clearly something the U.S. was doing to benefit itself, and at least in theory was going to hurt them. So anyway, like I say, from the Japanese perspective then, from 85 to 87, all of a sudden their exports become very uncompetitive. And so the only way to deal with that, and their currency strengthens, so their exports fall. The way, you know, normally if you wanted to deal with that, you would just say, okay, just sit back and do nothing. The market will fix itself. The Japanese price level has to drop. But they didn't want to do that. Bank of Japan starts inflating, and look at what happens to their stock market, the Nikkei. I mean, this is just extraordinary. So this is where it was in 1985, January of 85. You can see it was roughly 10,000. And then that's about, I'd say, you know, midway through 1990, maybe late 1990, it peaks at well over 35,000. So that is just an astounding increase in a matter of five and a half years. And then it crashes almost as sharply, or as sharply, but almost the full amount. And then if you look, I mean, we're still here's the present, and I mean, it's nowhere near where it was. So with the U.S. stock market, just for comparison, right now the S&P 500 is a little bit shy of where it was in the 1999 peak. Right? So if you bought into the S&P 500 in 1999 and you disregard dividends, you would just about be breaking even. Well, it's probably lower now because the stock market's been tanking the last few days. But the last I checked, like a month ago when I was doing these figures, you were a little bit shy, but you almost broke even. I mean, so that's awful that you could have had your money in the stock market for 12 years and you're just hoping to break even, again, disregarding dividends. But, I mean, look at what happened in Japan. I mean, it's not even close. If you bought into the Japanese stock market in mid-1990, I mean, you're still down, what, over 70%, it looks like, just eyeballing it. And there's no hope in sight. I mean, that was decades ago. Okay, so you can see when people talk about the Japanese economy and how it's just stuck in the gutter, this is the kind of thing they're talking about, and this is horrendous. But again, from an Austrian point of view, and this is what Ben Powell was saying, you can see why the Japanese did the exact wrong thing, right? So they agreed to these currency interventions, perhaps reluctantly, perhaps basically with a gun to their head, that allowed their own currency to strengthen, and then, you know, they were trying to deal with that by inflating at home, which was the wrong thing, and that just fuels this huge asset bubble, and then when that starts getting out of hand, they start raising rates, and then the thing crashes. And incidentally, you can see why people refer to this as the biggest asset bubble in world history, because just in terms of the proportion, you know, the rate of increase, and so, I mean, that's unbelievable of how fast and how much that thing rose and then how quickly it crashed. Okay, so again, I'm not going to summarize all the statistics and everything, and some of it may be on the multiple choice quiz for Friday, so just be aware of that I'm going to force you to read the Powell paper, but you can go and see he gives a good chronology. That's partly why I assigned it. But just to give you the overall view here, what happened is Japan did what a good Keynesian government does. It didn't sit back and apply laissez-faire. No, the Japanese government came in and did all sorts of big spending, massive deficit, public works projects, and so on. And look what happened to its debt. So the gross debt went, so, you know, this stuff really started happening. I guess they must have really kicked it in like in 92 or so forth. And you can see there the debt was about 70% of GDP. And now it's just shy of 200% of GDP. So that's the gross debt versus the net debt. If you're curious of the difference, I haven't looked up the decomposition for Japan's figures. But for the United States, for example, the difference between the gross and the net debt, it's things like the Social Security Trust Fund. Or I think it even includes the government debt held by the Federal Reserve would be considered part of the gross debt, but not the net debt. So the net debt means the government debt held by the public, whereas the gross debt means government bond held by anybody, even if it's by another government agency. So right now, in the United States, some of the $14.3 trillion that was the previous debt limit was held by the Fed and was also held by the Social Security Administration. And so the net debt or the debt held by the public would be lower than that $14.3 trillion. Okay, so you can see when we say that the Japanese government tried deficit spending, that's not hyperbole. They certainly did try it. And Japan right now has by far the highest debt to GDP ratio among advanced economies. Okay, so now that I gave you that background, let's talk a little bit about the Powell paper. So the big picture here that I wanted you to take away from that is that the Japanese economy did try exactly the types of things that the current Keynesians and monetarists are recommending. So they tried massive deficit spending, and they tried expanding their monetary base. And it clearly hasn't worked. So it's a little bit ironic that people like Krugman, here's the rhetorical give and take, and here's what happens. The Austrian will say something like, oh my gosh, look at all the stuff Bernanke's doing and Henry Paulson and Geithner. The U.S. government is running massive deficits and they're just running the printing press like crazy. That's bad. You know, that's not going to rescue the economy. That's just going to make us. This is going to make this thing drag on and on. You're taking real resources from the private sector, diverting them to government ends. This is not the way to help an economy. You know, we need to have actual savings and investments to recover from the malinvestments. You're just propping up losers. We're just going to continue to linger along like this for as long as you keep doing these horrible policies. And you run the risk of totally debasing the currency and seeing massive price inflation. So Krugman hears that and he goes, oh, no, you guys are wrong. Japan did exactly the types of policies that I'm recommending, and they've been stuck in a slump for a decade, but they had low price inflation. So clearly you guys are wrong. Okay, let's move on now. So you see the irony. Krugman doesn't, you know, warning bells don't go off in his head that, wait a minute, the exact same policies I'm recommending are what Japan has done, because I need that to be true in order to prove that Peter Schiff is an idiot. So I have to say that Japan tried all the stuff I'm recommending, and we all know that Japan is awful right now, and it has been stuck in a rut for more than a decade. But the reason Krugman likes to use that is because the one thing that hasn't been true of Japan is they haven't had a exploding price level. The yen has not collapsed in value. And so Krugman likes the example of Japan to try to prove to all of the Chicago school and Austrian types who are worried about inflation to say you guys are morons, because Japan has been implementing these types of policies all along and they're stuck in a rut. So now what Krugman would say, just, you know, we'll get to Krugman later on in tonight's lecture, but just to anticipate, of course he's going to say, well, right, what I'm saying, though, is they didn't do enough, but they have been doing the medicine I would recommend. They just have been doing it half-heartedly, and they haven't been applying the medicine the right way that I said to apply it. But the point is, you idiot Austrians, given what Japan has already done, according to your views, they should be experiencing hyperinflation, and they're not. Okay, so again, this is just why things get so complicated and ideological when it comes to macroeconomics. You would think you couldn't have it both ways. And this goes for the Austrians too. And for a long time when I was warning people that, oh my gosh, the Fed is being very reckless here, and I was warning people that I think CPI is going to increase and you're going to see high food and energy prices and so on, a lot of people were saying, well, Bob, why didn't that happen in Japan? And I didn't have a good answer for them. And so tonight I'm going to try to give you guys some of my views as to what did happen in Japan and why you didn't see hyperinflation there. But the point is, the Austrians want to say huge deficit spending and big increases in monetary intervention lead to a stagnant economy and some Austrians would say, and risk debasement of the currency. And the Keynesians want to say, no, huge deficit spending and big interventions in the monetary sphere prevent depression, and if they applied in liberal enough doses, restore an economy to health. And so long as you're stuck in a rut, there's no danger at all of a bad, bad inflation, of rising prices. And so it's just funny that we're both looking at Japan, and the Austrians are going to say, see, that's exactly what we told you guys would happen, that you keep trying your crazy ideas. Look at Japan has run up its debt to be, double what most sane people think is safe for a country, and it hasn't worked, and they've done pretty healthy increases in their monetary base and so forth, and it hasn't worked. So you guys are nuts. They're still stuck in a rut. You know, you guys keep wondering what's wrong with Japan. How come it won't get out of this rut? Maybe it's because of all these unprecedented interventions you guys are doing. And then the Keynesians look at Japan and say, we told you guys that when you're stuck in a rut, pumping in a bunch of money does not lead to rising prices because they're in a liquidity trap. So, you know, you guys, your models are completely wrong. That's why you should trust us. We predicted this. And clearly the solution for Japan is they should have just inflated more. And there's a nuance. They should promise future inflation. All right. So we'll get to that stuff when we get to Krugman. Okay. So now something else Ben Powell says here. And again, just to repeat, if you haven't read the Powell piece, I'm not like doing a book report on it here. I'm assuming you've read it. And if you haven't, just you need to read it after this lecture because that's going to tell the chronological history here of what Japan did. You kind of need to know that just to see we're not setting up a straw man. Japan really did implement a lot of these Keynesian public works projects more so than other countries have. So what I'm doing here is filling in subtleties that you may not have caught just because Powell didn't elaborate. So what Ben says, it's Ben Powell, what Ben says is at one point he stops talking about the Keynesians and he starts talking about the monetarists. Because the monetarists, even though they're associated with the Chicago school, which generally speaking is free market, laissez-faire, they're not when it comes to money. And this is one of the huge differences between somebody like Milton Friedman and Murray Rothbard. Friedman does not at all think that if the Fed just sits back and lets things run their course, that it's going to be fine. He thinks it takes active intervention by the monetary authority to sometimes pull an economy out of a rut. All right. So Powell makes the point that the monetarists, their solution when the economy is stuck is to go with monetary intervention as opposed to fiscal expansion. So that distinction, again, in case you don't know, monetary refers to the central bank, you know, creating money, buying assets and creating money, whereas fiscal, expansionary fiscal policy means the Treasury engages in deficit spending. So the central government spends more than it takes in tax revenue, and it borrows the difference. All right, so both of those are viewed as expansionary by people who believe in propping up aggregate demand, but generally speaking, Keynesians are more likely to favor fiscal expansion, whereas monetarists are more likely to favor monetary expansion, as their term name suggests. And that also lines up ideologically. The Keynesians like big government spending, generally speaking, because, you know, the government can be a force for good. And if the government has to spend money anyway, it might as well spend money on important stuff like giving unemployment benefits to people and building bridges and roads and funding public schools and whatever the heck else they want the government to do. Whereas the Chicago school types generally don't like the government doing anything. And so if they think aggregate demand needs to get propped up, they're not going to want that as an excuse for massive government deficit spending. They're going to say, well, no, the central bank can just buy assets and increase the money supply. Okay, but let me explain this. This is also a good review that Powell says, specifically, the monetarists favor using the central bank rather than the Treasury running deficits because they think that the LM curve is relatively more steeply sloped and the IS curve is flatter. So what Powell has in mind is he's saying, if you draw your ISLM diagram, if you draw it so the IS curve is really flat and the LM curve is really steep, then you can see that if you shifted the LM curve, that would boost Y and little I, you know, so output, and little I would go up just a little bit, meaning interest rates wouldn't go up very much. Whereas if you did the same shift with the IS curve, the investment savings curve, then you wouldn't get nearly the same bang for the buck. So let's try with our newfangled environment here. Let me just try to go to the whiteboard. I hope that I don't blow up anything. So, okay. You guys can see these red lines, right? Okay, great. All right, so what I'm doing here is drawing a ISLM diagram. So there's the I. And then here's a Y. Okay, so remember, Y is total output or GDP, and I is the interest rate. So what he's saying is that the IS curve is really flat. So that's IS. I don't. Okay. Okay. I was using the wrong tool. This will be better. Oops. And that's that. Okay, so that's IS. And then let me switch back to the line and make it not as obnoxious. And then here's the LM curve. Right, these are mostly lines, so I can draw these. Okay, so now you can see how. I'll just do these really quick here. I'll try to make it dashed somewhat. So if I shifted that IS curve, you see what I'm doing? I'm shifting the IS curve either up or to the right, whichever way you want to think of it. So yeah, that would boost output a little bit. So the initial intersection was right there, and now because I've and the initial interest rate was right there. All right, so there is the interest rate initially, and here was the initial output. So now, if I push that IS curve up by, for example, the government running a bigger deficit, the new intersection point is right here. But look at that, just barely makes Y go to the right a little bit. You see how that new, whereas it pushes interest rates up a lot more. You see what I'm talking about? So interest rates shoot up, whereas Y barely budges. In contrast, the diagram is going to start getting messy here, but suppose I move the LM curve the same amount. So I'm trying to draw a dashed LM curve now. Then you see, so now we're intersecting the new LM curve with the original IS curve. So instead of having moved the IS curve, what if we instead had moved the LM curve? The intersection point would now be here. And so you can see it's the opposite of what we just did. So here, Y goes up a bunch, whereas I'm not even going to bother drawing it because it actually looks like interest rates might even have fallen slightly. Okay, so you guys get what I'm saying. So remember, I see someone asking about the definitions. IS is saying the line. This is all from the Keynesian, the Hicks-Samuelson Modigliani synthesis of the general theory, saying the IS curve is showing the equilibrium combinations of the interest rate and output at which total investment equals total savings, and the LM curve is showing the combinations of the interest rate and output such that the desire to hold money, the demand to hold money is equal to the quantity of money. Okay, so if the government runs a bigger deficit, that can shift the IS curve around because now there's more demand for loanable funds. So that's why the government running a deficit would influence the investment saving line. Whereas if the central bank just decides to create more money, well, that's clearly going to move the LM curve because now the money stock has changed. So interest rates have to fall to get people to be willing to hold a larger quantity of money. All right, so the point is, depending on how steep these curves are, a given shot in the arm can boost output proportionally more than it changes interest rates. So that's the argument that Powell is making. If you lost me on this, don't worry, it's not a big deal. I was just trying to relate this back to the previous week's lesson to try to keep the stuff current, right? Because you're supposed to know the ISLM stuff from last week, and Powell talked about it, so that's why I went through this. Okay, so back to the PowerPoints now. Now we're talking about Scott Sumner on Japan. So here, I chose this picture of him because this was the one that they used for my Mises.org article. It was from this year. It's called something like Following the Efficient Markets Hypothesis into Absurdity. And in the beginning of the article, I say that I really like Scott Sumner. I think he's a sharp guy, but I think he's insane. And I say, I don't just mean I disagree with him. I mean, he has a very internally consistent, logically coherent worldview, and he just goes step by step and comes up with conclusions that I think are nuts. And so that's what I mean when I call him insane, because in the sense that G.K. Chesterton talked about insanity. So G.K. Chesterton said, it's not that the insane person does things irrationally. He said, no, on the contrary, someone who's really insane is extremely rational. He can give you a precise logical argument for why, you know, he really is the king of France or something, or why he really is Jesus Christ, or why he really is a Martian. So he doesn't just babble and say nonsense. A really insane person can go through and have an hour-long conversation with you explaining, no, I'm you know, the king of France. And then you can go through and say, but you don't look like, you know, I have your birth certificate here. And he can give you an explanation for, well, no, that's not really my birth certificate. Da, 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 da. Right? So that's what he meant. So that's why I was calling Scott Sumner insane, that I've argued with him and his views, and I can't beat him. Like, he's got convincing. In other words, I understand why he thinks he's right, and all I can say to him is, Scott, you're crazy. Because what he thinks is that the reason the world economy is in such trouble right now is that Ben Bernanke has been too tight with monetary policy. That he thinks all of the symptoms that we are seeing right now are indicative of monetary policy being too tight, and he thinks the only way we're going to get out of this slump is if Ben Bernanke would just be willing already to inflate. Okay, so I see people going nuts in the chat box. I don't have time to get into it right now, but I'm just saying that's why I'm saying he's nuts. And the reason, but like I say, you might be thinking, well, Bob, I could blow up that argument in 2 seconds. No, you couldn't. That Scott's some whatever you're thinking of. Just like if the guy says, no, I'm really the king of France, and you say, but I've got your birth certificate right here. What are we talking about? The guy would have an argument that you couldn't actually defeat in 2 minutes. Like you know, he would refer to things, and you'd say, oh, well, I guess I don't know that this is a valid birth certificate. I just kind of assumed it was. You get what I'm saying? So it'd more be your common sense. Like, you would just know you're crazy. You're not the king of France. The same thing here. We all just kind of know, common sense, there's no way the reason we're in a rut right now is because Ben Bernanke has been too tight with monetary policy. And yet, Scott Sumner can make a very strong case that that's true. So anyway, I'm just doing that here because I don't want you to walk away from this lecture thinking that I think Scott Sumner is right on everything, because I don't. But the reason I'm bringing this stuff up is his thoughts on Japan actually started giving me a clue as to why you didn't see prices go through the roof in Japan, and also why I think the dollar hasn't completely collapsed since Bernanke has been doing his shenanigans. All right, so let's just go through this. So for our purposes here, you guys don't need to know anything about Scott Sumner's views on Ben Bernanke and so on. But I'm just giving you this context just so you know who he is. And like I say, I don't want you to mistakenly think that I'm endorsing everything this guy says. It's just I want to give him credit because he's the one who brought these particular facts to my attention. Okay, so in his blog post, he goes through and shows what his main point is, what Scott Sumner's point is that the Bank of Japan officials got what they wanted. So there's this story going around, or this narrative that Paul Krugman and others are putting out saying, yep, Japan's in a liquidity trap. The Bank of Japan has been trying and trying to inflate, and it's not working because they don't get that they're in a liquidity trap. That's why they're stuck with falling prices, even though they've been pumping money in. And clearly, you know, their government just needs to run higher deficits. And Scott Sumner is saying, no, Paul, you're wrong. The Bank of Japan is getting exactly what it wanted to. Its monetary policy has been a perfect success. It's just you keep thinking it was trying to achieve something it wasn't. That no, they got exactly what they wanted. And so what Scott says is that the Bank of Japan wanted stable prices. They wanted, in other words, they wanted their CPI to be level. And he said, and they got it. And he said, look, in this, so I'm making two points here. I'm going to come back to that in a minute. So first of all, just look at the Japanese monetary base, and you'll see for the period we're talking about, so after 85, you know, it actually dips down a little bit negative. Let me switch tools here, back to my arrow. Okay, it dips down, and then it goes up. Yeah, that's a pretty big spike. And then it goes up. That's pretty big. But then look, it crashes. And look at the zero line is here. All right, so it's not just that the rate of growth slowed. No, there was a point here where the year-over-year change was like negative 23%. So that means here, and it looks like it was about early 07, maybe possibly late 06, I'm just eyeballing the chart, the Japanese monetary base was about 21% lower than it had been just 12 months prior to that. All right, so Sumner is getting at is that the Japanese have not just been inflating and inflating and inflating and banging their head against the wall and say, oh man, we're not getting any results, what the heck? No matter how hard we try, prices don't seem to go up. He's saying, no, they inflated and then they sucked money out very quickly once prices started rising. Okay, so let me jump ahead here in the chart. So if you're listening in your car or something, well, it wouldn't matter. If you're watching this at home and you're going along, I'm skipping ahead here to slide C, Japanese consumer price inflation, because I want to make this point that Sumner's making. So look, here, this is what Krugman has in mind. So here, this is negative. So Japan's CPI, the way they officially run those numbers, was actually falling in the early 2000s. I mean, not significantly. So here, at the worst of it, it was, what, like negative 1.5%, okay, at that point. You know, that was the year-over-year change. So prices right there at that point were about 1.5% lower than they had been the year before. So this is the kind of thing, the deflationary trap, this is what was freaking everybody out under Alan Greenspan in the United States in the early 2000s. Oh my gosh, we don't want to be like Japan. We better inflate, because everybody was saying, look what happened in Japan. They've been stuck in this rut with falling consumer prices. And so they've, you know, trotted all these arguments about how, oh yeah, if prices are falling, people don't spend, because why would you buy a TV if it's going to be cheaper next year? Or why would you buy a new car or a new refrigerator if it's going to be cheaper next year? So everyone's clamming up on spending, and we all know the way you get economic growth is for people to go to the mall and buy stuff. And so therefore, the problem in Japan was price deflation. So this is what they all had in mind. So what Scott Sumner is saying is, hang on a second. Yeah, here prices were falling. They were, you know, year over year prices are falling, and Japan wasn't pumping in monetary base. But look at here. In 05, prices went positive, meaning I said price changes went positive. The price level actually started rising again. And if you look back at what they did, starting in 05 there, and then zoomed, they sucked out 21% of the monetary base over the next 2 years. And what did that do? That banged down price inflation back to zero, the rate of change of prices. So what Sumner's theory is he's saying all along here, I think the Bank of Japan wanted stable consumer prices. And when they were falling in this period, they pumped in monetary base, but then once they started rising and dipped above, you know, so once they got into actual positive price inflation and CPI started rising, all of a sudden the Bank of Japan just sucked out a bunch of monetary base, engaged in incredibly contractionary policy. So that's what Sumner's saying. He's saying this has been a complete vindication of the Bank of Japan's policy. They wanted stable prices, and that's what they got. That if you look at the CPI over, you know, like an 8-year period from January 2000 to January 2008, let's say, the price level is roughly where it was. So he said, you know, what a perfect track record. That he said, show me a central bank that has done that before in terms of having stable prices. And he also talks about, I didn't reproduce it here, but Sumner also goes through and talks about how the Bank of Japan was raising interest rates during those periods too. And so he said, that's clearly not a liquidity trap, that when you're supposedly stuck in a liquidity trap, and we'll talk about liquidity trap in a few minutes, but the point is the liquidity trap has a lot to do with the central bank being rendered impotent because the conventional policy tools no longer work once the short-term interest rate, nominal interest rate, hits zero, because you can't push nominal rates below zero. And so that's has a lot to do with what the alleged problem with the liquidity trap is. So Sumner is saying, clearly Japan was not suffering from a liquidity trap when they were sucking out monetary base. In other words, their central bank was selling off assets and contracting bank reserves, and it was raising interest rates. He said, you don't do that if you're trying to be expansionary and you're butting your head against the wall. He goes, oh my gosh, nothing we're trying is working. He said, that's not what was going on there in Japan. Okay, so that's Sumner's point. Now, my point is to say, when Krugman and others tell us that he wasn't surprised that we haven't seen rising consumer prices and an inflationary spiral in the United States because Japan already did all the stuff that Bernanke has done, and he knew that Japan had price deflation even though it did all the stuff with its monetary base, and that only an idiot could possibly think that Bernanke would be inflationary with what he was doing. It's not as usual with Krugman. He's being a little bit fast and loose with the figures here. So that's what I'm getting at with this slide here. The Fed had a bigger surge, and it hasn't withdrawn the base yet. Okay, so just in terms of the raw magnitude here, look at what Bernanke did. From the 2008 to the height, here, so this chart now is percent change from a year ago. So here, before, when I was showing you the monetary base, that was the level. This, I'm showing you the percentage change from the previous year. So at the peak, it was like about 110%. So at one point in, I guess this would have been probably late 2009, the monetary base had more than doubled from just 12 months prior. So that is an incredible increase, whereas look at Japan, for the period we're talking about, the highest it ever got was about, 36-37% in terms of the year-over-year percentage increase in the monetary base. So for one thing, like I say, Bernanke has inflated far more quickly than the Bank of Japan ever did. And then another difference is, Bernanke just basically, he injected a bunch, then slowed off a little bit. The monetary base came down a little bit, mostly was treading water, and then he started inflating again. And so that's why you see here, this drop here, remember, these are rates of growth, and this line right here is the zero line. So this drop here, don't get confused, that's not Bernanke sucking base out. That's just him refraining from further inflation for a little bit. And then once the economy started faltering again, they announced QE2, and that was this jump. All right, so you see here, it dips below the zero line very briefly. And that, if you go back and look, that's because, there is a period there in early 2010 when the monetary base kind of drifted down a little bit, and it was a little bit lower than its level 12 months earlier, but just a tad. And then it shoots up again. And that's what this thing is doing. Okay, whereas in contrast, remember here, not only did the Bank of Japan not inflate nearly as quickly, but then a few years later, this thing went way below zero, and in fact, they were sucking out base at the rate of 22% a year at one point, whereas Bernanke hasn't done that at all. But now what I think is true here, and this is what Krugman gets at as well, So Krugman and Scott Sumner have been saying this, and I resisted it for a while, and now I've come around to it, is it's possible that the reason we're not, that the dollar hasn't completely crashed in light of that kind of thing, or the chart we showed in the beginning with the excess reserves, is that people think Bernanke's not crazy. That investors, bondholders and stuff the world over, people who hold dollar-denominated assets, they're thinking, okay, Ben Bernanke's not nuts. He doesn't want to destroy the dollar. Yes, he infused $1.6 trillion into the financial sector very quickly, but he's going to reverse that once the economy recovers. He's not just going to sit back, let the economy recover, and then banks start lending out those reserves, and then we just see, you know, M1 go up by a factor of 5, and you see prices across the board quintuple. Bernanke's not nuts. He's not going to let that happen. He's gonna undo these operations and have that monetary base shrink, just like happened in Japan. All right, so that's so I think that is part of the story, that expectations play a big role in this, and the investors, even though Bernanke's pumped all that money into the banks, so long as the banks are just sitting on it, there's no reason for the dollar to collapse. The only reason the dollar would collapse would be because of expectations. And so, you know, I think you do see that. Like, some people are panicked and they're rushing to gold, but a lot of other people are thinking, no, this is just a weird thing because of the extraordinary conditions that Bernanke faced. That's why he did this. This is not Zimbabwe. The U.S. government can finance its deficits by just borrowing from regular people. The Fed is not monetizing the debt here. Bernanke did that for monetary policy purposes, not because Uncle Sam can't pay his bills. And so they think he's going to reverse it. Okay, so now the fun stuff. Let's get to Krugman on Japan, and then I'll leave some time at the end for your questions. All right, so if you're reading his stuff that I assigned for this week, in the 2001 New York Times op-ed, he just continues with this bogus Hoover comparison. So I'm just going to state this in case you guys have never heard this before. You should have by now, especially if you read my stuff on Mises.org. But Krugman was talking about how the new Japanese prime minister was giving these worrying speeches about how there needs to be businesses that are unsound need to fail, and consumers need to tighten their belts, and we got to understand this is going to be a tough time, and unemployment might go up. And Krugman is saying, oh my gosh, that's just like what happened under Herbert Hoover. And to prove that, he quotes Andrew Mellon, who's Herbert Hoover's Treasury Secretary, saying, oh, what we need to do now in this depression is liquidate labor, liquidate real estate, liquidate stocks, da da da, and then you just purge the rottenness out of the system. And that's how we'll, you know, cleanse the economy of the mistakes, start out with a new solid foundation and grow from there. So a very Austrian type of school of tough love prescription for what do you do after there's been a boom. So the problem with Krugman saying that's what Herbert Hoover did, and then leading the reader to believe that, oh my gosh, the reason we had the Great Depression is because you had morons like Andrew Mellon running policy, listening to liquidationists like the Austrians as opposed to listening to Keynesian types. The reason that's completely bogus is where that Hoover quote comes from, where that Mellon quote comes from. It's not that Andrew Mellon wrote that in his diary, and that's how we know about it, or it's not that Andrew Mellon gave a public speech talking about the virtues of liquidation. No, Herbert Hoover, in his memoirs, years later, is recounting to the reader what happened after the stock market crashed in 29. Because remember, Herbert Hoover is the president of the United States from 28 to 32. So, well, that's when the elections were. So, the stock market crashes while Herbert Hoover is in office, and Herbert Hoover in his memoirs says there were two schools of thought that arose after the stock market crash. He said one school of thought was represented by my Treasury Secretary, Andrew Mellon. Mellon told me that the right thing to do in light of this financial crisis was to sit back and do nothing, to allow liquidation to proceed, liquidate, and then he like quotes Mellon saying, liquidate labor, liquidate real estate, let us find a natural bottom and purge the rottenness out of the system. Right, so that's where that shocking quote comes from. It's from Herbert Hoover in his memoirs reporting, this is one train of thought, this is one school of thought, the advice I got from my Treasury Secretary. And then on the very next page in Hoover's memoirs, you don't even have to turn the page, at least in the pagination that I have in my volume, Hoover says, but what Treasury Secretary Mellon was overlooking was the amount of suffering this would cause. And so then I ignored him, and we went and did something else. Okay, so Hoover is reporting what Mellon said to tell the reader, don't worry, I didn't listen to him. We went ahead and we implemented the boldest intervention of any administration in U.S. history to try to rescue an economy. Okay, so it's just, you couldn't be more academically dishonest without just simply lying than what Brad DeLong and Paul Krugman do with respect to Herbert Hoover. Now, in fairness, maybe Krugman back in 2001 just didn't know that. You know, maybe he was just repeating stuff that, you know, he hadn't investigated. But at this point, I and other Austrians have beaten this thing to a dead horse, or beaten the horse to death, whatever the metaphor is. So they have to know, and yet they still say stuff like this. Like Hoover still, or Krugman still talks about austerity measures as being like Herbert Hoover. So anyway, now that I've gotten that out of my system, but I want you guys to know that Herbert Hoover was not a liquidationist, and where we get that Mellon quote is from Hoover in his memoirs explaining why he didn't follow it. Okay. So what's a liquidity trap? The definition I'm giving you here is from me reading Brad DeLong and Paul Krugman in various spots talking about it, and so I think I'm synthesizing the main points, right? So there's very few places where they come out and define what do we mean by a liquidity trap, but this is what I'm gathering. So I think this is all correct, what I'm saying. I don't know that, you know, if you ask them off the top of their head to define it, if that's what they would say, but I believe this is a fair summary. So what happens in a liquidity trap is that conventional monetary policy becomes ineffective. So note that I italicized the word conventional. You could do unconventional things, like buying long-term assets, or you're doing something else that we'll talk about in a minute. But when they mean conventional, they mean the standard thing, textbook procedure. When the central bank wants to stimulate the economy, they buy short-term government bonds in order to push down short-term interest rates. And then at lower interest rates, businesses want to borrow and invest more, and consumers want to borrow and spend more, and that's supposed to raise aggregate demand. So they're saying that becomes ineffective when you're in a liquidity trap, because if the economy is such that nominal interest rates, that even if you inflate and push down rates and they hit 0%, and that still isn't low enough to restore full employment, well, then you're in a liquidity trap. Because the central bank cannot push short-term nominal interest rates below 0%. And for obvious reasons, right? If interest rates are 0%, what does that mean? I have $100 in cash. I lend it out at 0% interest. That means next year you give me back my $100. So if the nominal interest rate were negative 1%, I lend out my $100, and next year you give me back 99. So why would I ever do that? I would just sit on my $100 and earn a 0% nominal interest rate. Okay, so that's why no matter what the central bank does, it can never push the nominal interest rate below 0%. Now, a thing that Brad DeLong talks about is he says the way he kind of approaches this. So he endorses that, but he says really if you think about what's going on is what happens when interest rates, short-term interest rates, get really low. He says at that point, the government bonds, if the interest rate on them is basically 0%, short-term government bonds, are basically the same thing as reserves with the central bank, that they're both assets that are denominated in that country's currency. One is, you know, backed up by the full faith of the government, and the other one is like the legal tender money by law, and they both offer basically 0% interest. So he's saying from the bank's point of view then, the commercial bank's point of view, when the Fed comes in and says, oh, we want to stimulate, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to buy $100 billion worth of bonds, and already the interest rate on those bonds is virtually 0%. He says, what are you doing? You're just swapping virtually identical assets. right? The central bank is basically creating $100 billion in new money, giving it to the commercial banks, and then taking $100 billion worth of bonds from them. And so in terms of conventional policy, if you're just buying short-term bonds and the interest rate on them is already basically zero, Brad DeLong's point is you're not doing anything. You're not stimulating. All you're doing is swapping assets that are basically the same thing. And so it shouldn't surprise you then that nothing happens, that that's not causing people to go out and spend more. Okay, so the reason Krugman thinks that there's a liquidity trap in Japan and why he was so confident when he said that Bernanke's policies were not going to cause massive price inflation in the U.S. is because of charts like this. He's saying, look, in Japan, monetary-based growth rates exceeded 30% at their height, but look at M2, yeah, it was growing, but not by much. And M2, remember, is it's M1 plus a few other things that are put in there. So if you got the point I was saying, if we did M1, it would look somewhat the same, I think. Okay, so Krugman's point here is, yeah, the Japanese central bank, the Bank of Japan, was trying to inflate like crazy, buying assets and pumping up bank reserves, but the banks weren't lending out those reserves. They were just piling up as excess reserves, and the broader monetary aggregates hardly moved. So he's saying this is showing the ineffectiveness of monetary policy when you're in a liquidity trap. Okay, Krugman on – hang on, let me just see here. Okay, so the last slide, I'll talk about what Krugman suggested. Let me hear, spend just a few minutes, Krugman talking about Milton Friedman, because this is kind of general knowledge and stuff you guys should know if you're interested in this. If you're taking this course, you should know this kind of stuff, even though it's not directly pertaining to it. So Milton Friedman says the problem in the Great Depression was that the Fed didn't inflate enough. That after the 29 stock market crash, there was panics. You know, the economy starts faltering. People start getting afraid, taking their money out of the banks. And so M1 and M2 start crashing. Because if you think about the fractional reserve nature, if you pull your money out of the bank, that's reserve, you know, the cash in the vault is going down. And so from the commercial bank's point of view, if its customers start withdrawing their money in the form of currency and closing out their checking accounts, the bank's getting in a tighter and tighter position because, yeah, its outstanding customer deposits are dropping, but so are its reserves, and it only had 10 cents in reserves for every dollar in customer deposits. So if those two things are going down dollar for dollar, the bank is getting in trouble. So it needs to call in loans. It can't extend new loans. So that's what was happening. You had that credit crunch going on. And so M1 and M2 start crashing because people are panicked and pulling their money out of the banks. So Milton Friedman said the Fed, seeing that, should have inflated more. They should have bought a lot of assets and bumped up the monetary base. And that's the way the Fed could have counteracted this problem. But since the Fed didn't do that, the money supply fell by a third, meaning like M1 or M2 fell by a third from 29 to 1933, and that's why prices were falling so much, and that's why the Great Depression was so awful, is because the Fed did not inflate enough. So what Krugman is saying, having in mind this chart, he's saying this shows you why Friedman is wrong, that expanding the monetary base per se doesn't cause M1 or M2 to go up. If you're in a liquidity trap, that excess monetary base just sits there. So his point is that's why Friedman's wrong about the Great Depression. That even if the Fed back then in 29, 30, 31 had inflated like crazy, we have no reason to believe that M1 and M2 would have gone up like crazy. Okay, so now finally, what then does Krugman say? So this is a subtle point, but he has been saying it for years, so he's not making this up. All right. Krugman favors fiscal policy, you know, so the government running budget deficits, because he thinks the central bank doesn't have the credibility to do what it would need to do in a situation when there's a liquidity trap. All right, so to repeat, Krugman has conceded time and time again that theoretically you wouldn't ever need the government to run budget deficits. Even if you were in a liquidity trap, he said, yeah, the central bank does have the ability to pull the economy out of the liquidity trap. But you might say, well, how's that possible? Didn't he just say, by definition, a liquidity trap is when monetary policy fails? But that's why I stressed, no. A liquidity trap is when conventional monetary policy fails. You can try unconventional things. So let me illustrate what Krugman's talking about here. So I think this diagram actually comes from Krugman himself. I did a Google image search, and I'm pretty sure that this comes from one of his articles. So here, note this R. It's not a little I, it's a little R. So if you're not aware of the distinction in macroeconomics, the little R stands for the real interest rate, whereas the little I usually stands for the nominal interest rate. So nominal interest rate means the actual contractual interest rate charged on loans of money, whereas the real interest rate means the nominal rate taking into account changes in the price level. So if the nominal interest rate is 10%, I lend out $100 and I get $110 back next year, but in the meantime, CPI goes up by 3%, so prices in general go up by 3%, then my real rate of return, the real interest rate, is roughly 7%. Yeah, I get 10% more dollars back, but now the dollar is weaker because prices have risen by 3%. So the real interest rate is only 7%. Right? That's the idea. So what Krugman is saying is, suppose the economy is stuck in a rut like this where, you know, this is like a conventional loanable funds diagram. So here is the demand curve for investment, you know, loanable funds for investments. So it's declining in interest rate. The lower the interest rate is, the more people want to borrow and invest. And here is the upward sloping supply curve for loanable funds. The higher the interest rate, the larger the quantity of funds that people want to save. And Krugman is saying, when you're in a situation like we are now, where the economy is awful, so businesses don't want to invest much because there's not much demand for their product, and where people are panicked and they're saving more, or they're very over-leveraged, you know, households are carrying a lot of debt and they're worried about the future, so they're trying to pay off their debt. What you have there is, you know, compared to normal times, the investment curve shifts to the left and the supply curve of savings shifts to the right. And then what can happen is the market clearing rate can be negative. You see how this is zero? And so where those two things cross is negative. And so what Krugman is saying here is, right now, the economy, given people's desire to save and businesses' unwillingness to invest, the market clearing real rate of interest is negative. And he, elsewhere, I think he said it was like negative 5% or something. Like, that's what he threw out of numbers, what he thought it was. So now you say, okay, but you can't make the nominal interest rate go negative. The lowest it can be is zero. Well, wait a minute. The real interest rate is a function of not just the nominal rate, but also the expected rate of price inflation. And so Krugman is saying, it's true, the central bank right now can't get us out of this rut by pushing down short-term nominal rates. But if the central bank could convince everybody that next year prices were going to be 10% higher than they are right now, then even though the nominal interest rate stuck at zero, effectively the real interest rate would be like negative 10%. And so that's the way we could get to the market clearing interest rate and restore full employment. We could be, so because of that, because, you know, you're trying to think through the logic of Keynesianism, the problem is people aren't spending enough. And even at 0% interest rates, consumers are not willing to borrow and spend, and businesses aren't willing to borrow and spend, and people are still saving too much even though they're getting 0% on their money. So how do you get people to be willing to go spend their money and to not save so much? You debase the currency. You're not going to want, people aren't going to want to sit on their cash if prices are rising rapidly, because then the penalty for holding cash becomes too severe. So that's how this works. Is you say you get people to worry that their money is going to lose its purchasing power while you're holding it, so you rush to spend it, and that problem solved, because the problem is there's not enough demand. So what Krugman recommended for the Bank of Japan and what he recommends now is that they credibly promise to be irresponsible. That's what he's talking about when he says that stuff. And he's saying it to be cute, but he's serious. He's saying if the Bank of Japan could convince everybody, trust us, even though we've always been good about being hawks on inflation, we're going to not do that anymore. Starting next year, you're going to see prices rise. You're going to see higher price inflation than you've seen in decades from us. Trust us, we're going to get crazy. And then if people believe them, they would go out and start spending. And Krugman's saying the problem is the central bankers in the major economies have built up a good reputation for being inflation hawks. And so now in this crazy situation where what we need is for people to worry that they're going to be reckless, then nobody believes them. Because again, remember, conventional monetary policy doesn't work right now, according to Krugman. What would work is to convince people that in the future, prices were going to start rising. Okay, so that's where he's coming from, and I only have a few minutes now, so let me turn over your questions. And like I say, Krugman has been very consistent on that. Like you can see in his writings in Japan. When I was a grad student at NYU, Krugman came and gave a guest lecture at the Stern School of Business, and that's exactly what he was talking about. So this was in like 2001 or 2002, and he came and gave a talk saying how he ran the model and realized that the solution for Japan was the Bank of Japan needed to promise its people that it was going to have higher price inflation in the future. Okay. All right, so Michael Perkins said, modern Keynesians say that you want to foster inflationary expectations to avoid deflation. Can you elaborate on the reasons for wanting to do that? And so I think I just went through that part of the question. And then he says, just as important, why is deflation so bad and how does it suddenly enter the picture during the onset of a bust? Okay, so again, the reason people are, when they say inflation and deflation, they generally mean price inflation, deflation, so rising consumer prices or falling consumer prices. So the conventional wisdom is price deflation is awful, far worse than mild price inflation, because, and I'm not endorsing this, but I'm just telling you what the conventional view is. They say because if prices are falling, then people postpone purchases, and it sets up like a self-fulfilling prophecy where people aren't spending because, you know, if you're going to buy a new computer and right now it costs 1,000 yen, but prices are falling by 1% a year, well, then next year it's going to be, what, 990 yen for the same quality computer. So you would put off the purchase or with an automobile or whatever. And so that's what they're saying. If the problem is, if you're a Keynesian, and even the monetarists and other people, I mean, most schools of thought except the Austrians think in terms of aggregate demand, at least in some applications. So that's the thing that I think you guys need to realize. You may be sheltered and just have known the Austrians and the Keynesians. There are plenty of Chicago school type economists who agree that the problem right now is we have insufficient aggregate demand. It's just they disagree with the Keynesians about the best way to pump up aggregate demand. They think, you know, oh, you don't need the government to run budget deficits. That's crazy. If you got to boost aggregate demand, you want to boost total spending, just have the Fed print more money or do something else. Okay, but what I'm getting at is lots of people, not just Keynesians, think that if there's insufficient aggregate demand, that's a problem, and that can cause high unemployment and idle resources. So if that's what you're worried about, you can see why falling prices might be a bad thing, because then consumers might postpone their purchases. So I have a few responses to that. One thing is, I didn't mean to do it, but I chose computers, which is a bad example of that, because we have price deflation in computers all the time. Especially if you're willing to get the same model, right? So right now, to buy a state-of-the-art computer, if it costs $1,000, you know, for a certain quality combination, if you wait a year to buy that same computer, not the state of the computer a year later, but what was the state of the computer industry 12 months prior, if you wait a year, of course you're going to be able to get that for less money. So, but did I just prove that that's why no one ever buys computers? Of course not. Even though everybody knows if you're willing to wait, you're going to get a better model, we can still realize, well, yeah, but if I kept doing that, I would never get a new computer ever, and that's stupid. So you have falling prices, especially when you calibrate it towards for a given amount of quality, you have falling prices like crazy in the computer industry, and that doesn't prove that, therefore, the computer industry is stagnant and nobody can get a job in the computer industry. That's crazy. So I think the same thing's true in general, that once people adjusted to it, you wouldn't just have a succession of economic activity. People would just go ahead and make their purchases. Historically, we have seen periods of gently falling consumer prices over long stretches. In fact, in the 1920s, the roaring 20s, the consumer price index was gently falling from like 26 to 28, something like that. So, you know, just on the theoretically on the face of it, I don't see how that works. Then the other thing, too, is you could just flip it and say, okay, well, if gently falling prices are bad because they cause a snowball effect, that people stop spending, that makes prices fall even more, people stop spending even more, well, why wouldn't gently rising prices cause an accelerating snowball effect that, uh-oh, people are worried that their money's going to lose its value, so they go buy more stuff, but then that pushes up prices, so people are worried, and so you just see, you know, exploding aggregate demand causing massive price inflation. And so it seems like, you know, the only thing you could possibly have is stable prices, or else you're going to get massive deflation or massive price inflation. Okay, back to the questions. Well, I guess that was it. Well, somebody was responding. Let me see. Right, okay, yeah. So Jerry Stivall summarizes Rothbard's point, and I can, I guess, point it out too, that if everybody all of a sudden wants to have higher cash balances, and so they hoard their money, which is supposed to be like the most antisocial thing you can do in a conventional Keynesian framework, or even a conventional monetarist framework, to be frank, if everyone all of a sudden wants to hold more money balances, so how do they do it? Well, initially they restrict their purchases, so that makes prices start falling, and the way you restore equilibrium, if everybody wants to hold cash balances that are twice as high and the money stock doesn't change, well, the price level has to come down, or prices in general, if you don't like the term price level. And, yeah, I mean, that there might be a problem for a while, but once it adjusts, it adjusts. So the you know, that's kind of the Rothbardian take on that. That's also my take, that, like I say, historically we've seen periods where if the government and unions don't interfere, prices and wages can adjust pretty quickly. Okay, well, that was the end of the questions. We're over time anyway, so we'll stop there. So just to repeat, if you haven't read this stuff, I encourage you to go read it. It's not hard. And rhetorically, this issue of Japan is crucial to the current policy debate, because Krugman and others keep pointing to Japan as a complete vindication of their view, when at least on the face of it, you could say, if nothing else, Japan tried massive deficit spending and they're still stuck in a rut. So why do you think that Japan proves the efficacy of your views? Okay, talk to you guys later, and I'll post the quiz and send that out when it's ready.